Gray as a mouse, big as a house, nose like a snake, I make the earth shake. As I tromp through the grass, trees crack as I pass, with horns in my mouth, I walk in the south. Flapping big ears beyond count of years, I stump round and round, never lie on the ground. Not even to die, Olifant am I, biggest of all, huge, old, and tall. If ever you'd met me, you wouldn't forget me. If you never do, you wouldn't think I'm true. But old Olifant am I, and I never lie. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. Today we're looking at Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, book two, or book four, if we're counting all of them at once. I'm Scotsley, joined today by Pat. Will.
Hey, guys. Long time no see.
And Jason.
Hey, glad to be here.
So it's been a long time since we've gotten to talk about this book or any book in particular. So what did you guys think of it before we get into the nitty-gritty of it? Let's start with you, Jason.
Sure. Well, I think that J.R. Tolkien's probably one of the best story weavers of his time and of the ages. You know, this tale of Frodo, Sam, and Sméagol is epic, to say the least. I really enjoyed it, you know, like getting in my hammock and cracking this book open. It took me to a different world.
Yeah, with your Shire music in the background.
Yeah. I was listening to this Shire lo-fi on YouTube while I was reading it. I highly recommend that. It really puts you in a certain mindset.
Interesting.
What did you guys think?
Well, I'll jump in now, I guess. When we first started, I had joked about wanting to make a Dark Sam like fan fiction where in this part of The Two Towers in the movies, Sam gets kicked out by Frodo and Sméagol, and I thought it would be cool to do a Splinter timeline at that specific point. And now, having read the entirety of The Two Towers, I'm like, Sam is just, you know, a perfect soul, like just a wonderful, wonderful hobbit. And I can't even, like, it would take so much groundwork to get to a place. Like, I'd have to start much earlier and rewrite the whole series with a different Sam to be able to have a Dark Sam timeline. And it would just be an alternate reality.
And he's very similar. He's very similar to all the prophets that existed or possibly have existed, like Jesus Christ.
What?
Like a big cantankerous.
Go there right away. And you're going to call Jesus a prophet?
Well, think about it. I mean, throughout the adventure, Sam never really, you know, falls into the dark side or, you know, has this dark energy about him. And even when he takes the ring from Frodo, thinking that he's dead, and then eventually gives it back to him, like, he doesn't have any kind of ill will to him. And, you know, throughout the tower and everything, it's perfectly reasonable to say that he is a generous soul, really.
Well, I'll give you a generous soul, but not Jesus Christ, nor that he was a prophet. I don't think I'm ready to make that illusion. We're gonna have to put more groundwork to get there too.
I haven't got that far in the Bible yet to make those comparisons.
I'm not really sure who the guy is.
Yeah, judging from everything else we've read from the Bible is, you know, not what we thought we'd find in there.
I wouldn't compare Sam to Moses. He was a prophet, right? So
what about Joshua? Did he take out any cities?
Like, at best, I'd compare him to Samuel. Or no, Samson.
There you go. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. I go with Samson.
Maybe Frodo is more of a Samson.
No. Wow. I don't know. This isn't the discussion I signed up for. Why is everything compared to the Bible by Christians? Me, for the past year and a half, making this statement. Us, a year and a half into the Bible. What are we doing?
I just wanted to talk about Olifants.
We're here to discuss Lord of the Rings.
Well, so Pat, you mentioned when Sam took the ring, he didn't get swayed by the dark side, if we could call it that, right? And I noticed kind of a theme throughout this book, The Hobbit, and the first book, Fellowship of the Rings, where when one of the characters refers to the ring as their precious, compared to the opposite perspective of referring to the ring as like a bane, Isildur's bane. So when they refer to it as the precious, they're much more attached to it, and they seem to get drawn in towards that dark side of being attached to the power or whatever the ring brings to the character. Did you guys notice that?
Yeah, definitely. It made me think a lot about like the way that he wrote it in The Hobbit, where when Smeagol was using the word precious, he was generally just referring to himself, not necessarily to the ring. So I think there's something to that, where it's like they project a part of themselves onto the ring, so like they see it as not only rightfully theirs, but as a literal piece of themselves, almost like the you know, the Voldemort Horcrux, where it's like he takes out a piece of himself, puts it into a new item. I think it's maybe it's like some of the nature of the ring kind of extracts some of the individual and holds it inside of the ring. It's like you lose a bit of yourself when you obsess over little trinkets for your whole life. You know, that's what the Buddha tries to teach us.
Yeah, there was a scene from The Hobbit, a totally different book, but where Bilbo is unwilling to give up the ring. Or is that the Fellowship? I might be confusing two books. It's the Fellowship, where Gandalf asks Bilbo for the ring, and he like kind of turns into a creature, almost like Gollum.
Yeah.
And he's referring to it as the precious. And doesn't the ring give you some kind of additional vitality or extend your life?
Well, Gollum's pretty old, isn't he? Or Smeagol is pretty old. Like, how?
I think most of it has to do with just, you know, again, losing a piece of yourself. But it also shapes you into someone different, like creating a new identity for yourself that you cannot even recognize, but you just roll with that. Which segues to Will.
No, you took the words right out of my mouth. It's like accepting that power, it's impossible to have it not become your identity, right? Like there's tons of things that you can do that you don't have to become. I mean, when you're a teenager, there's one thing you do, and that's your identity. And same with like addicts, right? And it's that whole ultimate power corrupts ultimately. I think there's a few different things that you could pull out of that, and it's really cool that you Jason and Scott pointed that out, because I didn't catch that. But yeah, it changes their identity. It, as it consumes them, they consume it, and they're bonded.
Yeah,
it leads to the neurotic manner of Smeagol when he talks to him, to his other self. We can clearly see that.
Yeah, I guess there's like there's like a line you can draw between like the possessions that like form you as a human being, and like the social interactions that form you as a being, and like the choices that you make that form you as a being too. Like you could choose to identify yourself over like an item, or like any opinion on Twitter, or an activity, or like a combination of any. Like it's hard not to identify as a writer when you spend 8 hours a day writing, even if you haven't published anything, right? So like you start to identify with what you do as much as you identify with like what you use and what you consume in any fashion, like whether you're eating it or just watching videos. Like if you're consuming content online, you're extracting that and be you're letting that affect who you become as well.
And it's like, whatever it is, it puts you in different sort of circles and changes your perception. And, you know, with it comes opportunity and limits, right? And there are some things that if you choose to do them, there's more limits than opportunity. And I think that that's probably what the ring is, right? There's really only one thing you can do with that ring, and it's either hide it from everybody or use it to dominate everybody or destroy it. Like, you've got three options, and there's no saving the rainforests or blessing the rains down in Africa or curing the homeless or the right. poor. Like, it's just, there's three options, and there's a few things in this life that leave you in positions where it's like you could have done anything, but now that you're doing that, it's like you've got a few ways that you could go.
In a way, it's kind of like one of those novels that, you know, other stories that carry the what is known as the institutionalized genre, where the main character has to either join an organization, destroy it, or forge his own path, or, you know, even sacrifice himself in a way. And I think the way that Smeagol goes about this, he's obviously not choosing, you know, to do good and everything like that, but as he's guiding Frodo and Sam through the marshes, you'll notice that he's actually, you know, he's guiding them, but at the same time, he's actually deceiving them, sending them off into the wrong pathway and everything, and then all of a sudden reappear. And that kind of reminds me of how characters like that are questionable, but you want to keep them around as the audience. You want to know what their motives are, and there's this kind of cycle that, okay, like, do I have to trust this person? You know, are they going to bring something good, or are they just going to completely fold and show their cards, everything like that?
Well, and it's like, you see that a lot where, you know, the character is exposed to having to make a deal with someone that they wouldn't be friends with and they wouldn't want to keep company with, but they're at a position where that person has what they need, and so they have to do the thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask the question, which of the hobbits do you think takes the right approach to, like, the treatment of Smeagol, like Sam or Frodo? But I think the combination of the two of them combined, like that whole good cop, bad cop situation, is really the best one they could have gone with. Like, Frodo's kind of like giving him the benefit of the doubt, like, he's showing us the way, Sam. Let's keep him around. And Sam's like, I don't trust him.
Well, I think Frodo, like, doesn't he pity Smeagol?
Yeah.
Well, and for whatever reason, right, that's the two people that we have dealing with Smeagol. And what happens is you get something approximating the middle way, if you look at it like that, right? Because they're both pushing and pulling in different directions, and they have whatever experiences and values that have brought them to this position, to be in that position. And I was just thinking about, like, which of the fellowship could survive on their own. And it's like, other than Gandalf, or, and not even really Aragorn, right? On their own, everyone would be almost just hopeless. But as long as there's two of them, they have the ability to work things out together. Like, Gandalf is a god.
Yeah.
And Aragorn is going nowhere on his own. He's going nowhere really slowly. And Legolas on his own in the woods is just, like, again, not even part of reality, but exposed to evil and trying to do anything. They have to band together. And as long as they're together, they have hope.
Yeah, not even necessarily physically together, because they're all in different parts of the world right now, but they're still on the same path, metaphorically speaking. They're still all working in tandem.
But it's interesting, because like we've been doing the SMART goal stuff this year, and with the SMART goals, right, you get the end picture and then you work your way backwards with every single step. Like if I was there, what did I have to do the day before? What did I have to do the day before? With these hero's journeys, it's like I need to do this thing. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I do know that this step forwards will sort of get me there. And I have no idea if I'm going to be able to take my second step, but it's out of my control. And they just move forward until they come across something that gets them closer. And it's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and you really see that in Sam in the moment where, all is lost. He doesn't know how to go any further. Like, he has no idea if his best friend is alive or dead. Just has to accept it, move forward. Like, that's pretty heart-wrenching, honestly.
Yeah. And at that point, he just completely breaks down, right? And then just stays near until something moves forward.
Are you talking about near the end after the Shelob, the Gloom Weaver, has poisoned Frodo?
Yeah. So, like, when Gollum lures them into the spider's den, the spider gets Frodo. But then they find out, like, later when the orcs are talking, like, oh, the spider doesn't eat dead people. It just injects them with this venom that stops or slows their heart and makes them cold. And then she just eats them later when they wake up or whatever. I don't know. Because they're messed up like that.
What was the light that Frodo and Sam and the vial used? Because I really like the play of darkness and light when they were in the pitch dark tunnel and they pull out this vial of was it like sunlight or something?
I believe it's some form of starlight, as it were, but it's that elven
Starlight.
vial that he gets from
Galadriel.
Yeah.
Galadriel.
Yeah, I mean Tolkien is he's really playing with the dark side versus the light side. I mean Shelob is known as the Gloom Weaver, and I believe Gollum referred to the sunlight as some kind of contamination.
Yeah, we talked about this in The Hobbit, didn't we? The whole notion of
Did
the
we?
darkening of the monsters and their inability to face themselves in the light and because of the mountains and the goblins. Maybe that was just Fellowship.
Maybe. I had in one of our chats I put forth one of my theories that the whole reason that these like corrupted creatures can't like they can't bear light or whatever is because only in the light can they see their shadow. So like as soon as they're confronted with the shadow version of themselves, that's what freaks them out, and that's what sends them recoiling in fear and, crippling self-analyzation. Because when the abyss stares back, it's a scary thing.
You were talking about trust a minute ago, Will, and there was one quote where I believe it was Frodo. He said, "One good turn deserves another." He was talking to Sam regarding Sméagol's life, essentially. I believe they were going to kill him, but he did something good for them. He brought them some food and was showing them the way. I don't know. I resonated with that. One good turn deserves another. Of
Yeah,
course,
because
Gollum's only doing it to eventually get the ring back. Like, that's his end goal. A bit devious.
yeah. Do you think if Gollum spent enough time with Frodo and Sam, do you think he could have ever been like redeemed? You think you could have ever found like friendship in Frodo? Or was he just too far gone?
I think that Sméagol would have died if he hadn't have died, but the ring was destroyed. I think the chance of getting the ring back was the only thing that was keeping him alive.
Right.
Yeah, I think he was too far gone. The stinker side has like killed the slinker.
Yep, poor Squirrel, Stinker, and Slinker.
And there's kind of a similarity with Sam, too, because there's that moment when he thinks that Frodo is dead, and then there's this thought of, well, if he is gone, then I have to bear responsibility, because at this point, I cannot bring the Ring Bearer with me. I cannot hold on to him any longer. And that's another, you know, heart-wrenching moment right there, is when Sam decides to take the ring, but doesn't even know where to go, even without Frodo in any way, not with Frodo helping him or you know, even worse, Smeagol stalking him all the way to Mordor.
There was one interesting aspect of carrying the task of carrying the ring that I noticed, where Frodo is talking about the weight of it, like as if he felt that added gravity pulling itself down. And I thought that was interesting, because there's an idea in Buddhism where if you're working on a hard task, you feel the weight of it. But then if you just set it down, take a rest, take a breath, and then go back to it, maybe 20 seconds later, 20 minutes later, that you feel that weight lifted off your shoulders.
It's the power that comes with the ring. It's, you know, it's kind of like that. It's kind of like holding a barrier in a way. And the more you try to push it, the more it just wants to keep pushing you back and everything. So, yeah.
I don't think the whole waiting 20 seconds or 20 minutes thing really worked much for Frodo. It was like there were scenes in the movie, right, where they'd like take turns carrying the ring. And as soon as Frodo would like put it back on, it'd be like, oh, right back to the worst of it. Turns out just putting it down for a second didn't help, even a little bit.
The movie is quite different than the book.
Yeah.
Where I think the director,
especially mixed this one.
Yeah, he mixed the timelines up, shuffled them together. Whereas in this book, the first half is three characters, you know, Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas, and then the second half is all about Smeagol, Frodo, and Sam. Which I thought it was easier to read that way.
Yeah, than I liked
it. It's a bit confusing.
Yeah, and then you have Faramir showing up in this one, and you get to have conversation between him and Frodo about Boromir, and that's eventually how Frodo learns that Boromir has died, so I think that scene was pretty well written. Just in the way that they were, like, analyzing each other, like, I don't know if I can trust you, but as soon as I know that I can, I'll let you know what you need to know. They end up helping each other, and it's real wholesome. And
well, it's interesting because, like, it's a world that you're reading, really, right? Like, it's not so much the story or the characters or right. What they're going through, but it's this current lore in a world, and you could have told, you know, 15 different characters' stories from around the different regions that ended up getting into the same battle, right? Like the third horse from the left. in every single battle, and what that guy was doing and how he experienced it, or one of the villagers that got kicked out of a village, and you could have still approximated the world, but you fall in love with certain aspects that aren't even really written, but you get this entire creation. It's kind of like with Harry Potter, right? Like the wizarding world, and with Lord of the Rings, we have the fantasy world, and with Star Wars, we have the sci-fi world. And once the world's been created, it goes on living of its own volition. You get all sorts of people that say, I'm going to create something in this space, in this world.
Yeah.
Yeah, what really helped tie it or connect it to the world we live in was his description of the trees and plants that we have here, that we also see in the in Tolkien's universe. And like he's describing the food, you know, the rabbit stew and the red Leicestershire cheese. And it's like, yeah, I know that stuff.
Yep.
You're hilarious, Jason. Did we mention that you made soup? Was it mushroom soup from a recipe based on the books? Was it a mushroom soup?
Yeah, there was a book. I don't know the name of it, but we can put it in the comments. How to Live Like a Hobbit. And one of the chapters was cooking in the Shire. Yeah, I made a mushroom and a vegetable soup with some Guinness beer in it. It's delicious.
Nice.
We'll have to censor that, but very good.
Nah. It's good. Legal.
I'm 20.
They're not sponsoring us. It's very interesting, Jason. You know, that's not at all how I relate to the books. The cheese did not make me feel like their world was similar to mine. But for you, you know, you're listening to the music and you're making the food, and that's a totally different type of human, and you're very interesting to me. For me, it was the emotions and the experience and the thinking behind the characters and the implied belief systems and ways of life that I can see in others and in the characters and in myself that brings that world to my world.
Did you relate to any of the characters in particular?
No.
Okay. Completely objective.
And then you got Scott, right? And he's, you know, the writer in the group who's trying to, you know, share a little poem at the start of each video with us, because he's like, oh yeah, guys, did you like that poem? Did you like that song that the elves sang in like three pages? What is it that you relate to most, Pat? What's your cheese?
Well, honestly, I have no cheese in this one. But
what's your cheese?
I mean, I can relate to some of the struggles that Frodo and Sam go through, and just, you know, I'm sure we've all had moments in our lives where we had to go through such struggle and everything like that. That's what I think about, really, because that's what makes us human. The actions and the decisions we make and how it affects us. I mean, sure, a character can be different, but you can relate to some of the struggles. Like, for example, if you are stuck trying to, you know, figure out what to do with the ring when your ring bearer is no longer with you, that's kind of like, you know, hitting rock bottom when your mentor dies, like your business mentor or your meditation mentor or any kind of mentor in general. It's like, well, what do I do now? I mean, I have all this information here. Should I continue to spread the word of my mentor, or do I create my own? It's that kind of dilemma in a way. And really, that's kind of what I see the most from these characters.
So at the end of this, maybe one of you guys could remind me, Sam takes the ring off of Frodo after he's been wrapped in the spider's web.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. I guess what we were talking about earlier, you know, the position of Frodo and Sam, whether they have to trust Smeagol or just get rid of him. Like, if you were in one of those positions, I guess what I was asking, how you relate to any of the characters, what would you see yourself doing? Like, trusting like Frodo did, or more in the perspective of...
Like, in general, or how would we treat Smeagol? What are you asking?
Yeah, yeah. Like, how would you treat Smeagol in that position?
Oh, I'd beat him up. Like, I'd just abuse him. I'd just be like, I think you are less than me. I'm going to subjugate you and enslave you.
What kind of question is that, Jason?
I would treat him with goodness and honesty and humility. I would give him the benefit of the doubt and a piece of my bread.
Which one is it, Will? Which one is
If he had what I needed, I'd do what I would need to get what it is that he had. And I would prevent myself from corrupting myself to whatever degree I could.
Okay, interesting answer. That's kind of what Smeagol's doing. I mean, they have what he needs. He's kind of doing that. Same, he's not killing them.
Assuming I'm dealing with, like, a lecherous, scummy individual. Hopefully, you know, between rational men, I'd just perform a trade. And it would be kosher and rational. But with a Smeagol type, right, and in a crisis, all of our everyday ethics go right out the window. And it's like, well, I don't know what I would do if the entire fate of the world depended on my success and this guy had the tools to get me there. Like, everything I possibly could, hopefully.
Yeah.
That's a fair point. It was a poorly worded question.
If I had a friend who was a Smeagol, I wouldn't. I'd set boundaries. If I had a classmate who was Smeagol, now we can get into the realm where we can maybe play with this comparison. Because if you have someone that you have to deal with, in a classroom, this is the perfect comparison. How do you deal with a Smeagol that was a peer
or a coworker?
Boom, here. Now we go after it. So what would you do, Jason, if you worked with a Smeagol? How would you handle them? They're on your team for a project.
Does this Smeagol have, like, the multiple personality disorder where he keeps switching between Smeagol and Gollum?
Yes. So again, this doesn't quite work.
So, like,
they didn't. That guy didn't get the job. Hopefully.
Oh, jeez.
Hopefully, he's also in a different classroom because that teacher is not equipped with the tools to deal with Smeagol.
Yeah, I kind of am avoidant, so I'd probably try to change classes or get the stinker to change classes.
Typical white male privilege. Okay, go on.
Wow. Stinker.
You call me stinker?
No, I'm just saying, stinker.
That's the thing. There isn't a comparison for this, right? Because that's not the type of world we're trying to build. But in a crisis, right? And that's where you get, so when you have people in society that live like a Smeagol, how do you deal with them?
Let's really try to create a real world scenario of a Gollum. So he has to be like obsessive over one thing, you know. There's lots of people obsessed over one thing. They're called drug addicts. So what can we say about that?
Well, addicts of any nature, right?
Yeah.
Depending on the severity. And that's the thing. How do you deal with that? But then, and it's not even to the same degree, but it's like mental health illness.
Right.
And then it's like, wait, so what if everybody that falls under this umbrella is quintessential to the human journey and could be the one that cures cancer? And it's like, they have what we need.
Yeah,
but they're so focused on what they want. They're so focused on what they want. They can't even see what they could possibly become. And it's like, we see what needs to happen. And what do we do about that? That's the only place that Smeagol is, if Smeagol's going to be anywhere.
Yeah, it's really tricky.
You're almost just asking the question.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry, go ahead.
You go first and then I'll go.
I'm saying you're almost asking the question, like, how do you get people to realize their own potential and work towards it?
But it's like, maybe that's just me being too optimistic, right? So it's like, just what do you do when you have to deal with people? Because multiple personality and selfish gain, that is people. That is proletariat. That is the unclean masses. Like, that's everybody. Because you don't know anyone. You have no capacity to be certain. You can develop a few close relationships where you're pretty confident that the people in your circle are the people that are in your circle. But something could happen. Trauma could strike tomorrow, and it could alter that person's perception of the world. So, like, you can't guarantee that what they want is good for you, but you can see that what they're doing could help you, or that they could be of help to you. And, you know, there's a risk working with them, but you can't get to your goals without working with them. So if the average person is Smeagol, how do you deal with Smeagol? You know, do you show up in the Facebook comment sections to try and have a healthy debate? Do you volunteer? Do you give back? Do you participate in town council? Do you attempt to inform and bring awareness to certain causes? Or do you go to work and drink or watch TV or meditate or listen to music and make hobbit meals and not engage with the Smeagols of the world? What? And that's, I think that's the question every book puts to us in some capacity.
What do you do when you have to deal with Smeagols?
I think Paul had a lot of sense when he recommended this trilogy to us. And yeah. I don't know if,
speaking of Paul,
he planned on us comparing God and Jesus to Sam by this point, or if he was betting on it taking longer, or us getting to comparisons faster.
I don't
Did
think
he plan all of this?
I don't think that's the parallels he wanted us to draw. I think of it, I heard him say in like a bunch of his older videos, like, if you're Frodo in the Shire and you're looking for God, say Tolkien is your God. Where do you find God? It's in all of the other characters that Tolkien has created. It's in Gandalf, it's in Sam, it's in everybody, and we're all united under that author, right? And there's a quote that really made me think of that.
Dude, stop talking for a second. Let that just sink in. That's a great statement. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
So I'd like to add, let's send these videos to Paul and have him give us an analysis of who we really are.
I think he subscribed.
He doesn't have time for that.
You're right. He probably doesn't. I was about to say, he subscribed. He watches all our videos. But
no, it would be good to have a discussion about that. It's very, I'm glad we're reading this trilogy.
Yeah, here's the quote that I found. It starts off with Sam saying, "I wonder what sort of tale we've fallen into." "I wonder," said Frodo. "But I don't know, and that's the way of a real take. Take anyone you're fond of. You may know or guess what kind of tale it is, happy or sad ending, but the people in it don't know, and you don't want them to." "No, sir, of course not." Well, it's a little fun exchange between Frodo and Sam about a little bit of breaking the fourth wall, almost. Like, what a fun little story we're in. But if
That's
you think
really
about
great.
Yeah, but if you think about it in the way that it's like, we're all in a story. Like, we're not in a book unless, you know, that is the analogy that we're living right now, where God is the author and we're all characters in his story. But
or if you're friends with Hemingway, right? Like,
exactly. But I think that's just a good way of looking at life. Like, what a story this life is, you know? Like, I think that's always something you can fall back on. And going back to the other the other analogy I was talking about, I think it's, even if you're not religious and you don't care about, you know, understanding God, I think you could understand a lot more about the universe and yourself just by, you know, talking to anybody on the street, your neighbor, your people on an online forum, whatever. Just connect with people and you'll connect with the, you know, whatever, the transcendence.
I don't know. I think there should be some criteria. I think I thought that too and fell into some connections that did not get me anywhere.
Well, I'm not but saying you should.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. I did learn about the world.
I'm not saying you should make too much out of those connections. But like maybe
what?
Maybe it goes back to the node in a network analogy where you just have to understand that you are a node and all these other nodes are firing off too, and you know, maybe an acquaintanceship is a little bit better than saying, oh, look at that guy who I hate and don't understand and I could never understand. And like, maybe try talking to that person and understand them for a couple seconds at least.
Well, assuming you take the perspective of, you know, life is a story and your character in it, which implies a bit of fate from the author writing you. If you don't like the way that story is going, you know, how do you change your own path? Hmm. You know, if you feel fated in, towards one direction.
I would simply refer to you the writing technique wherein someone travels to the future to secure, or the past to secure their existence in the future. And then I would just say, you know, time is not just like a linear thing like you think it is. It's more of this big ball of timey, wimey, wibbly wobbly.
Stop. I'll give you a real answer. I was going to say, any good storyteller knows that what a character needs is, you know, some kind of a transformation arc. So, I don't know, if something happens...
Look for your arc? Look for your purpose?
Yeah, like, there's got to be something out there for you, right? Like, you got to transform into something.
So, I can add on to that. Yeah, you do need a transformation arc, obviously. But you also need to figure out who you really are. Your identity. Which kind of goes into the other story archetypes, like the Seeker, who is full of imagination and has full of ideas and wants to innovate a lot of things, but is too much of a perfectionist and too much of a stubborn-natured fool to even listen to other people who offer him suggestions or criticism. Or you can be the orphan or the caretaker or the warrior. And once you figure that out, then you have to figure out what your transformation is, and then you go towards that.
What
were you gonna say, Will?
Oh, I just, right after you finished describing the Seeker, I raised my hand to see if he would let me offer him a suggestion, and he didn't, and he failed my test.
Oh,
he was on a roll. But maybe in this analogy, that finding out who you are is, you know, what you do through interpersonal dialogue and meditation.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like identity is something that you look at in hindsight and you say, okay, well, that approximates this identity. And then you use it as this sort of psychotechnology of evaluating yourself to say, is that, like, does that fulfill me? Does for some reason, am I satisfied with that for inexplicable reasons? Or am I dissatisfied with that? What is it I don't like? What do I want more of? I don't think you ever, like, you don't, you're not in grade 12 and you're like, okay, this is who I am and this is what I'll do and this is how I'll do it and this is why I'll do it. It's like, you're attracted to stuff and then you look at how things are going and then you sort of alter your course, and there's identities at different stages of your life. Like, I feel like I just found out the whole reason that teenagers like get something and they're like, oh, this is my identity, this is who I am. It's like, well, that's the first time in our life that we've been able to even do that and say, I like this. And then of course we're gonna make it our entire identity. We've never made anything our entire identity. Up until that point, our entire identity was pooping and eating and uttering nonsense. Yeah. And then hopefully you get to a point where you can do two things, maybe even three.
Yeah.
What do I know?
More than me, apparently.
No, I know nothing.
All I know is that I know nothing.
I have looked her in the eyes.
So I'm curious to know more about the Oliphants, Scott, since you opened up that quote and everything. Maybe expand upon that a little bit.
Well, they're elephants.
Yeah, it was a war elephant coming from the southern tribes.
Have you seen the movies, Pat?
I'm asking Scott.
Yeah, they're like...
Boom roasted.
I don't know, they're like big Indian war elephants, I guess.
Well, how does that compare to the quote that you presented? Because I seriously don't know much about it.
I just thought it was a wonderful little poem, and it was fun.
Yeah, I made it up on the spot, right?
Yeah. He's a real poet, that Sam.
I think there's probably more to be said about that notion that Sam just creates stuff on the spot. He's like, well, I don't really have a song for this occasion, and I don't know any, but I'll just make one up, and it's... there's something to, you know, doing it for the doing and not for the perfection of it. And that that's the point.
You can't create a Dark Sam out of that.
He's legit freestyling, dude. Like... Eminem ain't got nothing on Sam Weiss Scamgy.
There you go. Wasted.
Who's Eminem?
Oh, you know, the candies? You never tried those?
Oh, I love it with the peanuts.
Yeah. And caramel?
Yeah.
I mean, caramel?
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Those are delicious, too.
What are you guys making in the States? I've never had a caramel M&M.
I've seen them up here in Canada.
No.
So, do we have anything else Two Towers related to bring up?
Well, I kind of had a question in the back of my mind. You know, Sauron and his forces... What is their ultimate goal? Is it just to take over the entire world? Like,
I haven't really heard from him yet.
I mean,
that's true.
I think it's kind of one of those things where it's like he's like this dark lord and he's all powerful already, but like once you have power, all you want is more. Like, the more you get, the more you want, kind of thing. So it's just like, well, what's the next step? I guess it's kill all the elves. What's the next step? Just conquer all the kingdoms of men. What's the next step? Well, I guess it's get my ring back. What's the next step? And it just keeps going on and on from there.
You know, I imagine an alternative ending where Sauron and his forces actually find the ring and they take it and they're like, okay, we're all good, guys. We're going to go back to our end of the Middle Earth. You guys can, you know, rebuild your kingdoms. It's all good. We'll shake on it.
Yeah, we just wanted to use it as a power source. It keeps our light bulbs going.
Yeah.
You know, like the dwarves just wanted the Arkenstone in their home under the mountain, right? Then they were happy. So what if Sauron was in the same boat? Who's to say?
Well, he did start that war. And that did sort of destroyed half the world, and all of the races got together to destroy him.
All right, so there's some plot holes.
The running theory is that, like, he would probably just try and restart the war and win,
yeah,
and destroy everyone, and take over the world. That I'm just inferring that from what I haven't we haven't heard from him. We don't know what Sauron's opinion is. It'd be great to hear Sauron's side of things. I would read a trilogy about him as a teenager.
Yeah, I'd read that. I'm just thinking, like, after they burn everything to ashes and rubble, if they're going to build something up out of it.
Diary of a Wimpy Sauron?
He has so much
he's
angst.
He's working for the elves, and he's not doing a good enough job. He's got a crush on the princess.
Oh, it's Galadriel, isn't it? Everybody wants her.
His dad is the vacuous behemoth darkness that the world was shaped out of when his mother destroyed his dad.
How can you live up to that? Relationship. Oh, jeez.
Get on it, Pat. You're just going to start writing fan fiction that we create on our podcast. We're going to create a publishing company. You're going to do fan fiction, you and Scott, eventually.
Okay.
That's how we'll actually supplement our income. This is just a brainstorm think tank.
Yeah. Definitely.
All right, I like that.
Tune in next week for our blog post teasing Diary of a Wimpy Sauron. He needs like a cheesy Valorian or whatever the race is, Valarian curse, where it's like, oh, fizzles to Valar.
How once wimpy teenager suffered from angst and became who he was today. Who he is today.
That's a good log line. You know Sauron, right, the Dark Lord. But did you know how he got here?
Did you know that he had a speech impediment and difficult sight?
Okay. Are we,
He once used a giant glass mirror to see everything.
And then they trapped him in that.
Oh, jeez.
So what's coming up in the next book?
I believe the king will be returning.
Yes.
Yes.
Which king? Who knows? It's a mystery.
Maybe we can finally figure out what Sauron is. Mm. We can actually see his face, as Will mentioned.
He's some kind of like god, right? Like Yahweh for the test.
No, he's like middle tier.
Yeah, he's like the fallen angel.
Upper middle tier. He's like upper middle class at best.
Yeah, he's like Lucifer. He's like one of the angels, but he's like a captain. Then
he's not like evil. Buy his wife a $15,000 dress rich, but like he's pretty affluent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And with that,
like, comment, subscribe, Bookwave on YouTube, on Anchor, on Spotify, on Stitcher, all those good podcast websites. Bookwave.club is our website, and may the force be with you.
We're equal to mass times acceleration.
Oof, poof.
Later, guys.